Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast. Here to talk all things Arsenal is your host, Matthew Wade.
Hello again, listeners, and welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast, a sort of end-of-season weekly podcast because the season has ended. And joining me to talk through, the final game of the season, have some reflections on the things that immediately preceded it, and maybe a nod towards slightly longer-term reflections, which we will continue over the summer. I have, Anita Sambol, all the way from Croatia. Lovely to have you here. And Helen Trantum, all the way from, not far outside London. Lovely to have you here, Helen, as well.
Hello. Thank you.
We might be joined by Paul Williams as well, who is wending his way to us as quickly as humanly possible. But unfortunately, as the three of us on this call, all people who have small people in their lives, sometimes recording times have to be coordinated in interesting ways. Anyway, I hope you'll forgive us and forgive the intrusion of the small people. In any event, after what had been quite a traumatic week preceding it, at least a nice way to finish proceedings for the season. How was Arsenal 5, Everton 1 for you guys?
Well, it seemed like a really nice day out on the Emirates Stadium. Nice and sunny, great result. And what I've seen on social media, everyone was there and had fun with people, with friends. And in the end, that's all that matters. And kind of, forget about what you said was not really a great week. But, you have to mention that and talk about that. I mean, it was a really good game, much better than the first Everton match this season.
Yes.
Well, I think that it was really a good way to end the season for the players as well, because they seem to really be enjoying themselves during that match, and some got probably some really nice goodbyes from the Emirates crowd as well. So I think that all in all was a really good shame that Norwich didn't deliver as well.
Helen, what's your immediate takeaways?
Oh, well, I was at the game and I was saying to my dad as we were walking to the ground, for those who aren't married yet, if you want to get married and you want to guarantee yourself a sunny day, the best thing you can do is pick Arsenal's last home game of the season. Because I swear to God, I've been going for 15 years now to the stadium, and every single time, I think it's been the final night. It feels like it anyway. It feels like every single time it's glorious sunshine. It definitely feels like Arsenal play better when it's sunny as well. unlike Monday nights. So then the atmosphere is good. The crowd already feeling pretty chirpy before you even get there. And so like Anita said, a good day out. And it's really nice to finish the season on a really positive, upbeat note. Because I think generally the theme of the season has been positive and upbeat, but it's easy to get lost in the detail because of a sense of what might have been, what was there for the taking.
Yes, it's sort of that, how to divorce yourself from, not divorce yourself, but not be overwhelmed by the feeling of being pipped to the post by the old enemy, particularly a noxious variety of that particular ensemble as well. When things were within our control. But ultimately, one has to balance that against the fact that the point total we've achieved this season would have seen us third in either of the last two seasons. Would have seen us finishing above the current, and for a couple more days yet, current reigning European champions. And it represents significant progress from where we were. Which is what you'd expect, given that we didn't have to juggle different competitions as much, and given that there was significant investment this summer and some of the dickheads have been punted out the door. But it is important to have a good finish under the circumstances if you've got a final home game, because it allows everyone to reconnect with that feeling rather than just being left with the unpleasant taste of the previous two fixtures. If the final game of the season had been the defeat at Newcastle with all that entailed. Mm-hmm. I think that would leave the fan base in a different place to where it will be left, because they wouldn't have had that opportunity to reconnect with what has been positive. And I guess as someone who was at the game and has obviously been to more games this season than Anita or I, given that there's the atmosphere within the stadium appears, from, by all reports and from everything we've all seen, to have become so much more positive and supportive and on board with what's attempting to be achieved than it probably has been in a few years preceding that. I mean, how important do you think it was to have that positive connection between fans and players on the final day again after a traumatic few weeks, I guess?
Yeah, I think a lot of our strategy over the last year and a half has been built around bringing in prospects for the longer term, you know, bringing people who aren't the finished article with the potential to grow. And that's something that the crowd have been able to get behind over the course of the season. But it's also something that I think we needed to show in the last game that we were behind, because it would be easy. There's a guy who sits across the aisle from me who, he does this awful whistle. Like the fingers in the mouth whistle, it goes straight through your head. But he does that and then he gets up and he shouts. And poor Nuno Tavares, if he plays, I mean, I kind of understand it on the one hand, because plenty of people are shouting at Nuno Tavares, but this guy does it to quite a few different players. And you're just like, that's exactly what we're trying to get away from. We're trying to build a momentum that people can get behind. And you don't want the players to feel demoralized or disconnected. Like you say, it's that feeling that everyone's in it together is the kind of thing that makes, hopefully will make them feel like they're part of something exciting, a project to get behind, something to stick with, where, you know, if they're wavering. It's I can't remember who I was talking to, but we were having a conversation about Viv Miedema re-signing and drawing the parallels and the differences with Van Persie. And it's one of those things where Van Persie obviously made all the noises about being in for the project and then pulled out. And we'll probably never know the exact ins and outs of why that happened. But it's probably not a stretch to say that he thought certain things would happen, certain promises were made that didn't then happen. And it's everyone being on the same page with these sort of projects is really important. So, you know, the players needed to feel that it was a positive season as well. And it's a good chance for the fans to demonstrate that, as well as for the fans to go away feeling upbeat.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's no doubt that for everyone in any situation, but particularly for younger people who are establishing themselves in their arena, you know, it's always easier to do your job well when people are encouraging you than when people are giving you abuse. I think that applies in almost any context in life. And as someone who's part of their living is frequently involved standing in front of large groups of other people, I can say that that's definitely the case in my experience. Sometimes it's quite fun to have the adversarial relationship as well.
But you've got players in that squad who've got decisions to make as well.
Yeah.
Right. So it can't have harmed the cause for Eddie Nketiah to have had, you know, the stadium chanting his name and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might end up being, you know, by the by and a complete irrelevance, but it's definitely not going to have done any harm.
Yeah, I think that the same thing is happening on social media as well, because obviously I'm online, following everything online mostly, and talking with people on Twitter mostly and all of that. And whenever during this season I dare to criticize and perhaps moan and be angry about Arteta and his doings and wrongdoings and bad matches and all of that, I got called out by random people who are following me. Don't be so negative, just, you know, support the team. Even got in discussion with Paul as well.
Yeah, I'm not a random.
I mean, you're quite random, but not a random.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like there is more positivity around the club, starting with the messaging from the club and from the players, with, as Helen mentioned, with the signing of Miedema as well, in women's team, not only in men's team, but overall. And how many times have players, you know, every time, basically, when they shared the message on their social media, it's always, thank you for support. You are amazing. Thank you. Thank you. And how the atmosphere is amazing and all of that. And think that it's...
And it has been, to be fair.
Yeah, it has been.
In my 15 years of going or whatever, it's definitely the most positive, united atmosphere that there's been by a margin as well.
But I often seen that happening over the last few seasons in stadium as well. You have seen comments online saying like, yeah, it's much better in the stadium. The crowd is much better. The match-going fans are much more understanding, much more positive. But during this season, I've noticed that that came on, I can't remember the word now, transmitted as well online. And not only in the stadium, like more positive feelings, more positive people, more patience, you know, see what we are building, it's going forward and all of that. Of course, there is criticism and there are moaners and angry people, there always will be. But I think that it's not only in the stadium that atmosphere is more positive, it's online as well.
I'm just going to say Paul Williams has joined us as well, who was also at the game at the weekend. So we'll get your first impressions in just a second. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what both of you have said very much. It's quite funny, though. I spent a little bit of last night looking at an Arsenal forum that I haven't looked at for a little while, that I believe Paul may have had a previous familiarity with, shall we say. And let's just say that the bonhomie hasn't necessarily bedded itself in all corners in there. There are still a lot of people on the internet who are determined to justify stances that they've held for some time.
I was going to say, some people are just entrenched. So they've left themselves, they've built up the entrances so badly that there's no exit left.
Yeah, very much so. It's kind of like, well, I decided that this was going to be crap 3 years ago. And even no matter how much specific evidence you can prove to the contrary, I'm sticking to my guns. And I suppose people relate to that in all ways in life. We see it with voting patterns, for instance. You know, it's people don't, a lot of, most people, most of the time, don't really like to engage with evidence with everything. And some people never engage with evidence.
No, and I think also everything we've just said about young players and inexperience and all that sort of thing, that also applies to the manager. So I think most people would say that he's had a very positive influence on the club, but there have been errors and mistakes along the way. So by definition, if you're looking to justify a viewpoint, you're going to be able to find, you know, statistics, damn statistics and lies. You're going to be able to find something to back up your point if you're that deeply entrenched. So,
well, it's also because it's just the very nature of being a relatively passive observer to a process means you can never have a full understanding of the ins and outs of the process, which leads to speculation is inevitable. And full speculation always results in people leading into their biases, because that is what it is. That's the way that brains function. Paul, how was the weekend for you? Just sort of getting impressions about the Everton match, the experience of being there, and the importance of these sort of end of season good vibes despite previous disappointment.
Yeah, I think we went to the 12 pins before the game, and although we were standing outside the pub, it was so loud because everybody was just singing and really up for Tottenham fucking it up, which obviously, sadly, didn't happen. Not that anyone was seriously expecting it, I don't think.
No.
And then going to the game, we, as I mentioned before, we were right next to the Everton fans, who immediately arguments started. I don't think we'd even sat down and they were starting arguments with us. One lad in particular, he's like, use a fifth. It's embarrassing. Apologies for my embarrassing Scouts accent there. With no hint of irony, bearing in mind that Liverpool were going for the title that day and Everton have just about avoided relegation. And Everton are quite a big football club. Well, they used to be anyway. And then
they're
game
spending us in recent years.
Yeah.
Spent more than pretty much anyone in recent years when you look at it in certain terms.
Yeah.
So the game itself, I think you know, as you thought might happen last week, Everton were basically on the beach. It was a bit of a contractual obligation fixture. Arsenal moved the ball quite well, kept the ball. They weren't moving it particularly quickly. The penalty was quite funny because I was up that end of the ground and it was a big shout for it. And we weren't sure. But then given the length of time it took for the decision to be looked at, it was quite obvious to me that there probably was going to be a penalty given.
Yeah, there was a long stretch of play, wasn't it, before it then went out, and then they did the VAR check. And I said to Dad, well, if they're still looking at it, that means there's something in it at this point, because if it was nothing, they'd have looked at it and gone, and we'd never have known about it.
Yeah. On TV, it looked like, why do you need VAR for that?
Oh, there was a little moment of Alex Iwobi is a gooner.
One of our own. That's what we were saying.
He's one of our own, yeah.
he looked very peed off about it, mind you.
Yeah. And then, of course, Martinelli, as you also predicted last week, gets his goal. And Nketiah swiftly follows up. And it felt at that point, really, that the game was done. And then Everton scored a goal, which from the other end of the pitch looked like really bad defending from us.
It was a midfield runner. Didn't track the midfield runner.
Yeah.
Because actually I thought Gabriel did a reasonable job at covering off the near post, which was the imminent threat. Yeah. But then no support backing up in behind.
It was Donny van de Beek basically doing his one special power, which is an ability to make late third man runs into gaps in the penalty area. And that's what made us brilliant at that at Ajax. And he'd probably be quite good at it at Man United if they ever actually played him.
We just wanted to Bergkamp's granddaughter's father to feel good.
Yeah. Exactly right, Anissa. And then it kind of felt like the second half could potentially have been quite tricky, but then obviously we got two quite quick goals into the second half. You know, having spent 20 minutes moaning about him last week, what a brilliant finish from Cedric.
I had a good moan about him before he did that, though.
and he got an assist, and I think a pre-assist as well.
Yeah. Really well taken goal from Gabriel. And then Martin Ødegaard put the goal. But the really funny thing about the Ødegaard goal, apart from the message my uncle sent my cousin, which was, why can't he do that when it's 0-0? was almost immediately after we scored the fifth goal, news came in that Man City had scored their third goal, and the Everton fans were going absolutely ballistic next to us.
It looked like they were celebrating our first goal as well. It must have been when...
I think it was the second one. The second goal.
Yeah, there's definitely one in the first half that they were celebrating as well, because I was like, why are they celebrating our goal? Till it became one, it was presumably nothing to do with us.
No, it was Pedro Neto.
Yes.
So it was a bit of a strange play because really, obviously, Arsenal had the game won pretty much for most of it. And there was so much commotion going on in the away end that there was probably more people watching than football watching. But I really enjoyed the North Bank clock end rendition we got in the second half. The clock end were absolutely incredible throughout the second half, which was nice to see the Ashburton army making their presence felt in the ground. And actually, at the end, you might have already said this, Helen, but the amount of people that stayed for the lap of appreciation was... I know in the past that's been a bit... met with a bit of apathy, shall we say. But there were a lot of people staying, and when Saka came around, the players never really came too close.
I was going to say, it's funny, because it's the least apathetic the crowd have been, but I would say it's the most apathetic that the actual players have been.
Yeah.
But usually they properly... It felt... And I'll tell you why I think it is. I think it's because our squad are a bunch of kids So they're not old enough to have their own kids at the moment. Usually there are loads and loads of players' kids, and they're all running around and having a kick about, and they're all with their kids coming round. But that wasn't what happened. They seemed to have like mates with them, or like their sisters and things like that. So it was a completely different sort of atmosphere to usually on the Lap of Appreciation. And you got the odd person who came right round, like Ramsdale came over, I think, with his nephew, I want to say. Because
I don't know. I assume that was his kid, but I don't know.
Well, so did I. But then I saw someone on Twitter say that it was his nephew, him and who was the other one? Someone else as well. Because they were like, are they old enough to have kids? Well, yeah, that's how biology works, mate.
Technically, yes.
Yes, if it wasn't his kid, he was certainly throwing them very high in the air in time to the crowd oohing and aahing. So,
yeah. I mean, two things I just want to mention quickly while I think of them was we got to see, and you might not have seen this from where you were, Helen, Bukayo Saka giving Gunnosaurus a clip round the head.
Oh no, I saw Elneny giving Elneny's kids hacking him down.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dele Alli getting an absolute load when he tried to run the ball out for a goal kick, and then Granit Xhaka managed to win a corner off him, which we then scored from.
Which was doubly funny, yes.
It's quite funny. He shanked one out as well in down our end, and was met with raucous cheers for that.
He was quite, I thought he was quite clever, actually, because when he came over towards the Everton fans at the end of the game, he made sure he was quite close to Alex Iwobi. But he's still got a lot of wanker. So just a really fun day in the sun, although I think I killed James on Saturday night when he came down. We were drinking till 2:30 in the morning, so he was a bit of a zombie.
A bit subdued, was he?
a little bit. And we then had the joy of getting him onto his train at Euston. Walking down from King's Cross to Euston, there were police everywhere.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Leeds, Man United, Everton. And I actually got some abuse in M&S. Some Leeds fan clocked my Arsenal shirt, having literally said to James about an hour previously, "Oh, Leeds fans are all right as long as they're happy." And this guy saw me, and he'd been singing a chorus of "We all love Leeds." So I can put two and two together. And he saw me and he went, "Fuck off, you boring cockney twat wanker, your team's shite." And I was like, "Yeah, we just won 5-1, mate." "No, fuck off." And I was like, "Oh."
I have to say, my Brentford mate would have been particularly disappointed that they managed to somehow balls up that to keep Leeds up.
Yeah, well, interesting. One of James's friends, I don't know if any of you guys have heard about this, but a friend or someone that James worked with had promised he was going to the game on Sunday at Brentford, Leeds fan, and he'd promised to jump into the Thames if they stayed up. Leeds obviously won their game and stayed up. And the bridge from Kew and found a spot that looked safe enough to jump in, but it wasn't quite as deep as he was expecting, and he's shattered his heel.
God.
Oh, dear God.
Leeds fans.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Hey, well, they do say it's grim up north.
I mean, just sort of extending on what's been said, I think one reason also the players undoubtedly are going to have been impacted in terms of their levels of enthusiasm by the fact they're still absolutely gutted about what happened. I mean, Arteta just couldn't even begin to hide where his brain's at the moment in post-match interviews, and I've heard that he sort of briefly appeared with the family on the pitch but didn't get involved in any wandering around and getting clapped, thank you very much, because he was so absolutely gutted, and he's already, let's face it, he's not the most relaxed character, so he's probably already sort of hot onto the next thing. And if reports in the papers are meant to believe, he was making sure that a bid for Yuri Tillemans was going in that evening. I mean, there's sort of limited value in talking about the specifics of the game anymore, because as has been observed, Everton were in post-party mode.
It's interesting you say that. I didn't feel like that. I felt like they played a very changed lineup, which obviously compromised perhaps their style of play. And it was nice not to play against Richarlison's spiteful petulance for a whole game.
Well, that's true.
But on the other hand, Calvert-Lewin was certainly putting himself around.
Well, I was just about to say, that the only Everton players who looked like they were really trying were Branthwaite, who's just trying to establish himself, Dele Alli, who was basically relishing his role as pantomime villain, and Calvert-Lewin putting a big fat "buy me please" sign around his neck, because that's one of the best performances I've seen from him when I've watched Everton play this season.
Yeah, you were certainly under no illusions about why Everton were where they were based on how they played. But equally, I'm sitting there thinking, I don't love Calvert-Lewin. If he was our only striker purchase of the summer, I'd be devastated. He's not someone I would want to be starting 90 minutes week in, week out. But if he's someone who you can throw on with 10, 20 minutes of a game to go when you need a goal, who's going to put themselves about, going to be physical, going to cause a bit of chaos in a penalty area, well, isn't that a role that we kind of have a need for at the moment? You know, we've not had anyone who could do that probably since Giroud.
I mean, if you're looking at one potential profile of player that we're looking at getting is a striker who is both athletic in terms of covering ground, but also good in the air with a good leap. And there's a reason why I've been linked with Calvert-Lewin, Tammy Abraham and Victor Osimhen at Napoli, because they're all great athletes of varying degrees of quick to very quick and all got absolutely great leaps on them. And it's hard not to think that if one of them arrives at the club, suddenly Cedric's endless spamming of crosses might yield a bit more result than when he's aiming for the likes of Lacazette and Kesha in the middle. Each being double marked.
Then it will happen what usually happens. We stop crossing.
Yeah,
I always thought that when Giroud was playing that we put crosses in when he wasn't playing, and when he came on there was like one or two crosses and that's it.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think that some of the more, you know, there were lots of brilliant things about every part of the Wenger regime, even the more illogical elements towards the end. But, towards the end, there were more and more things happening. You're like, why are they doing that? And that was one.
Do you remember on this very podcast when we signed Mesut Ozil? On this very podcast, I was like, I mean, I'm assuming it was a podcast. It could have been a debate on the Slack group or something, or it could also have been an article that I wrote. But I definitely remember being super, super excited about the prospect of finally having someone who could play a ball over the top for Theo Walcott, who, let's face it, his only real skill was running fast in behind a defence and then finishing with aplomb. And then we didn't do it.
Yeah.
It's like there's nothing more Arsenal than finding the perfect combination of players and then making them play in a completely different style.
Well, I mean, without wanting to go down that route too far, one of the things that was interesting about Ozil, brilliant playmaker, but not someone who played what you'd call traditional through balls. Like Fabregas was the king of the, yes, I'm going to play it in between the centre half and the fullback, and I can do this all fucking day long, kids. So just watch me go. And there's a reason why Theo's scored a lot of goals when he got to play with Cesc. Whereas Ozil was like, well, I could do that, or I could play at an angle to the opposite corner of the box to an onrushing fullback that is still, before I play the pass, will be 40 yards out of the picture. No one will have seen. And I'll do that because that's really fucking cool. And there's a bit of element of that. So he didn't always choose the most efficient process. Anyway, digression. I mean, so going back to the game itself, what do you think about the fact that, I'm phrasing this really badly, I apologise, but more goals from set pieces? You know, the Arsenal team that were categorised for years, so basically post George Graham, can't score from bloody set pieces. And this season, I think we're the second or third best team in the league at scoring from set pieces, specifically corners.
And right up there as well in defending them, for that matter.
Yeah.
It's like the exact inverse of what we usually do.
Which, given the issues we've had in scoring goals from other situations, has obviously been key to us getting to where we have been. I mean, I just wondered if any of you had any thoughts on that. And also the fact that we seem to have also managed to make under-hitting crosses to the near post to be flicked on by back heels from whoever's standing the near post to be a thing now.
I mean,
well, it's the Nekasaka tactic.
Gooners of our generation, Matthew, it's great, isn't it? I mean, the near post flick on from Martinelli for Nketiah. That goal was, there was something almost casual about that goal that I couldn't quite believe we'd scored. I guess my sight angle on the pitch wasn't great because we were quite low down. But then you get the one to the edge of the box that Cedric smashes in, which we've been trying for most of this season.
Difficulty being we don't have many people who can finish from distance.
But we tried it already in that game.
I saw someone on one of the forums I was looking at yesterday be quite sniffy about the fact that we scored five goals, but three of them was from corners. Yeah. It's like, how many games did Chelsea win under Mourinho when they defended for like an hour, nicked a goal from us? That's how they used to beat us for about 5 years. They defend, score a goal from a set piece, defend some more, hit us on the counter-attack, game over.
Also, it's notable that the only teams to have scored more from us this season from set pieces are Liverpool and Man City.
There you go. I mean...
Yeah. Elite company.
And it's, I guess... I guess I'd be more concerned about it if I felt that we weren't also creating chances. I mean, we had 26 shots on goal on Sunday. Martin Ødegaard has created chances all season. We've just not taken very many.
Yeah, I mean, him and Saka are both in the top five chances created in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ødegaard was 72 in the Premier League. I'm not sure how many.
What does that mean, though? What does that stat mean? Because, I mean, my eye test when I go to games is, and like you say, Paul, I don't care if we score loads of goals from set pieces. As far as I'm concerned, they're a bonus. The more of them you get, the better. It's more if you're then not creating from open play as well to complement that. If you're only relying on set pieces, then that's a problem. And if chances created means you play a 2-yard sideways ball to Nuno Tavares, who shanks it 50 yards over the bar...
just reminded me
how much you can read into that, right?
Well, it's that chance. I test.
Yeah,
it's stats like that. I mean, even the shots number is sometimes falling. You know, as you said, that Nuno Tavares shooting the ball far away still counted as shot at goal.
Yes, and,
you know,
it should count as a clearance, really, shouldn't it?
Something but hide the other parts. So.
Well, that's why you have to look at stats aggregated. I mean, this is actually one of the things that, you know, a lot of the whingers have been kind of, you know, the people that were being alluded to earlier about, you know, fifth is not good enough and should we settle for it and blah, 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 blah. The fact is that if you look at all the aggregated stats, you know, whether it be XG or XG for and against and the balance of that or chances created or shot creating actions or blah, 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 blah. You know, even attacking metrics, defensive metrics, we should be in fourth. You know, we're literally almost all of them, we're fourth or third.
But also the improvement in all of them over the course of the last 12, 18 months is really strong. But it is interesting because my eye test when I go to games at home is that we do still struggle. I'm not saying we don't ever do it, but we do struggle still to create chances in open play. It all feels quite formulaic. There's definitely a degree of players don't look, you know, like when you watch Liverpool or City, their players look like they're free to choose what they're going to do and they sort of make spur of the moment decisions. Whereas ours feels very based on patterns. And sometimes that means opportunities are missed. And you notice it particularly when Tavares plays because he does not play as part of a pattern.
He's Mr. Chaos Agent, yeah.
Absolutely. But which create, and that's actually when we've created some of our best chances, is because he's doing something a bit different. And it's something that the opposition haven't prepared for, you know. They've prepared for the fact that Bukayo Saka is going to cut in from the right wing onto his left foot and try and ping one in the corner, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
Can I just say on Nuno Tavares, before I forget to mention it, I really enjoyed watching him on Sunday. I really, really hope that we persevere with him, because I do 100%. Think I think there's a player in there, and if we can coach the rough edges out of him a little bit.
Well, if he can learn to shoot, like literally, because he puts like all the good stuff together, and then it's like the last little bit just needs to.
the break he had in the second half when he just charged through the midfield, he cut in and then he lines it up from about 30 yards. And I think it ended up in the upper tier, maybe. It was.
But
I love that.
That was one of his better efforts, in fairness.
We were 4-1 up at the time. Why not have a dig?
Yeah, 100%. And it's exciting.
Yeah.
You know, it's at the end of the day, it's an entertainment.
And also in his professional debut for Benfica in the top flight, he did score from about 25 yards out. So there's a reason. There is something to support his decision making, just not the execution. I would totally agree, and I get quite angry that there's a certain section of the fan base that has decided that he's a sort of ridiculous figure of fun. You know, led by the nose by the same pundits that we were referring to last week, when yes, he's got a lot of rough edges, and yes, his decision making is a bit scatterbrained at times, but the attributes he has is just clay to work with, you know.
Yeah, and he's 22.
Yeah, and
you know,
just
in the same way that all of our young, you know, like Saka, Smith Rowe, this season we've obviously worked with them on, you know, having more attempts on goal, improving their shooting, improving their shot accuracy, and it's paid dividends. So, you know, Tavares has played a handful of games all season, and I understand not trusting him in games that you expect to be, you know, really tight, 0-0, 1-0 type affairs. Like, you don't want chaos necessarily in those sort of situations. But sometimes you need a bit of chaos. Like, in the Newcastle game, he looked like our best outlet.
Yeah, which is why I was disappointed when he got taken off.
Exactly.
What's your thoughts on Mr. Tavares, Anita?
I do enjoy watching him and his chaos factor, because you never know what will happen. And I agree that he offers a lot up front that other players in his position don't. And definitely agree that he's still very young and has potential, and definitely shouldn't be mocked or, you know, not played so often. I think that I was sad a few times when Ateta took him off, like that in at the halftime. I can't remember which match was that, when he had a really bad half, and he was taken off. But I mean, he's still very young, and when will he learn, if not that now?
Yeah, and I think one thing I'd hope would happen over the next season is that in those games when, you know, games like this one, you know, the home games in the sunny part of the season against teams that we really should be beating, but we know we'll set up defensively, that's the ideal time to give the guy a run out and allow Kieran Tierney to not fall apart by the spring, as has happened.
Well, exactly. We shouldn't be afraid to use players who are perfectly capable, as long as you plan it right so that you can play them in the right games. And that means then you'll have Tierney available, hopefully, for the games that you want him available, because he's not been played, you know, every minute of every match, including friendly matches for fucking Scotland.
Well, and indeed, that's a key point. I mean, there's a lot of different factors that have prevented us from securing Champions League football this year. but the biggest one has been that international break, where Thomas Partey obviously had an extraordinary experience in Ghana and then came back exhausted and not fully fit. Tierney did his knee playing two 90-minute back-to-back pointless fucking fixtures for Scotland, which means he can't play in their World Cup playoff. Real fucking genius manager there. And also Martin Ødegaard came back absolutely knackered and was well out of sorts for a couple of games. And you know, that's the difference. I mean, possibly
it's one of the many possible differences.
Yeah. You know? But we can say categorically that the absence of both Partey and Tierney has had a destabilizing impact on the team.
Oh, massively.
And it's made us more vulnerable defensively and less effective going forward. And you know, you'd like to think we might have snuck a victory against Southampton or a draw, you know, whatever. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. I mean, we could equally talk about a million other things. Spurs referee decisions. Lack of, not getting that game COVID cancelled. Yeah.
Things, shit happens, but it's when it's one rule for us and one rule for them. You know, it's like there was a photo of the Spurs squad after their game at Norwich celebrating in their dressing room. And you think, on a very like unbiased level, I'm like, you've succeeded in something you set out to achieve. You were never going to compete for the title. So actually, that's a really good result and you should celebrate. But what I don't understand is why when we do that, apparently it's the most heinous crime the world has ever seen. But when they do it, it's like, oh, well done, Spurs. Clap, 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 clap.
Yes, it's been a healthy return back to the days of no one likes us and we don't care, that as me and Paul discussed last week. I mean, we all know that the media has its biases. We all know that that Tottenham tend to get a slightly more favourable write-up in the press, partly due to the significant number of ex-Tottenham players or Tottenham fans within the press themselves, and that's just something we're going to have to live with. But as I was saying last week, it's almost nice to be slightly hated by all the arseholes again, because it now means it's a reflection of the fact they're slightly scared of us and worried about what we might do. And with that in mind, we've got to wrap this up relatively quickly. Apologies, listeners, I've got a child to collect, so that limits times. But I wanted to ask you each, without getting into specifics, because I know that a number of you are not very keen on talking about transfers and transfer speculation. So, but just what do you think, based on what you've observed this season and possibly reinforced by the weekend, what positions, say we could bring in four players, what positions would you see those players being in? Because obviously there's potential, we're being linked with everyone under the sun, and there's potential to bring in six or seven, but if we're limited to four, what would be your priorities? And who wants to go first on that?
Striker, definitely. All agree on the strikers.
Yeah. Well, if we're assuming that Laka and Eddie are going, we've got no one. So.
Yeah. Cedric replacement.
Yeah, backup right back. And a backup central midfielder, I think, really.
Yeah.
I think we need a starting centre mid.
Well, I was going to say, it depends. Depends what
or a number eight.
A number eight.
Yeah.
AKA the linked Yuri Tielemans or someone of that ilk. Even though that might not necessarily be our personal choice, that appears to be from what we're hearing, what the club are certainly investigating. And I suppose with his contract having a year left, if you
I've been quite impressed by Tielemans, to be fair, though, when I've seen him play. He's got a little bit of a propensity to give away a penalty, hasn't he?
He makes Xhaka
look... He'll fit in.
He's given away twice as many pens as Granit Xhaka, for Christ's sake.
Probably scored more than twice as many goals as Granit Xhaka, though.
I think that's probably fair to say.
I think he scored as many goals as all of our strikers this year, actually, in fairness.
Isn't Gabriel the top scorer for us in Premier League?
He's got five as well, I think. He's not the top scorer, no. Saka and Smith Rowe have got double figures, but Martinelli's got five, I think. Gabriel's got five, Eddie's got five, Laka and Obra both had four, I think.
Yeah. That's correct, yeah. All inspiring for £100 million worth of striker, although to be fair, one of them was only here for half a season. But
but you look at Spurs' front two of their front three, whatever you want to call it, and I mean, they've scored 40 plus goals between them, so.
Yeah,
it definitely does show this. There's definitely some room for improvement in that department.
Yeah, our goal difference definitely needs to be improved.
I think it will, won't it? I mean, if we get a striker worth the name, we're adding 20 goals to the season straight away. But I was wondering, and I tweeted about this earlier, I mean, there's a lot of talk about Serge Gnabry and he's possibly not going to renew his Bayern Munich contract next summer, so they may be looking to sell him. And I'm thinking about him, and I know he's played centre forward for them, but he's predominantly a right winger, which is obviously where our little star boy from West London's been playing for the last 2 years. But I wondered if we could sign someone like Gnabry, does it give you the opportunity to move Saka centrally And is that something that might be worth exploring?
Hmm. I mean, my view is that the value of someone like Serge Gnabry would be a little bit like Gabriel Jesus, although Jesus is slightly more confident centre forward, but you're looking at a forward player who can play in a number of different roles to a high level. I mean, Gnabry's played on the right, played on the left, both to a very high standard, you know, can do that kind of false nine thing or a variation of it. He's got a big enough bum to lean into defenders and hold them off a little bit in the Lacazette style, only he can then run into the box afterwards, unlike our erstwhile Frenchman. I mean, that's it, isn't it? We kind of know the positions. We know it's a striker. We know it's another midfielder. We know probably a right back, although that's not as high a priority because ultimately the hope is Tomiyasu won't have the same injury problems next season. And then it's probably someone who can, a second forward of some description, who can either play centre forward and just centre forward, or is someone who, depending on who the primary signing is, someone who can play in different positions, particularly if the club managed to sell Nicola Pepe, which one would imagine all parties are quite keen for that to happen. Certainly Pepe will be keen to go to somewhere he might actually get a game, and he hasn't exactly covered himself with glory for more than twice this season.
You know what I'd really like, though, from our striker? I'd like us to score at least one goal next season on the counter-attack. We're so, so bad at it because we don't play quickly. You know when I said earlier about it being patterns and formulaic? We don't play quickly enough when we counter-attack. And when you're one goal up, that's your chance, or you're two goals up, that's your chance to kill the game. We've struggled, we've lost and dropped points this year because we haven't taken advantage of those situations. And you look at Spurs, we all knew what was going to happen Thursday night. We all knew they were going to sit deep, try and counter-attack on us. And we played a lovely high line and played right into their hands with it.
I mean, we also probably all suspected they'd get a soft penalty as well.
Well, yeah, that too.
Lacazette did score a goal on the counter-attack this season.
Did he?
Home to Southampton.
He did. Very nice.
Did he have like a 100-yard head start?
Well, Bukayo Saka. Well, I was going to say Saka put it on the plate for him, but that would be a little bit unfair. No, it was a really good finish.
Yeah,
really good finish.
You take the point, though, Paul.
Of course.
That proves the rule, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, your centre forward's not going to score many goals off counter attacks if your centre forward options are either someone who can't run, someone who can't run up, or Eddie Nketiah, who's just establishing himself as a player and, you know, isn't the best all-round footballer as a striker.
Yeah, and you can argue Eddie scored a solo counter-attacking goal by nicking the ball off someone in their own half type thing.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of, they've had a corner and we take three passes. You know, like United used to do it to us all the time and it used to kill me every time. Like Park, what was his full name? I get them all mixed up now. Park Ju-song used to turn up with a goal against. It'd be like his only goal for the season would come against us on the counter-attack.
To be fair, we used to be lethal on the counter-attack as well. And the younger players in the squad do suggest that that is something that will continue to improve because they have the raw qualities in order to make that happen. Mm. But ultimately, unless you've got a generational phenomenon talent, you can't really expect players 20 years old and under to carry the burden of scoring all your goals in a season. You know, it's all right if that 20-year-old is Erling Haaland because he's got the physique of a 25, 26-year-old. But it's a big ask for younger players to sustain it over a period of season. And I suppose the big thing we're going to discover really is by the signings, which is why in a way they're going to be slightly more interesting than in some previous years, because we all know where the holes are, but we don't know what Arteta and Edu think the best approach of filling those holes is. You know, are we, particularly as the media are hedging their bets with their speculation, you know, are we going for a nippy, quick attacking player who can drift into channels, or are we going for someone who's physical and can hold the ball up and is really good in the air? And strange enough, those two players aren't often the same fucking thing.
I did think that earlier, Matthew, when you were banging on about how we're looking for someone who's very mobile and also jumps really high. I thought, yeah, they probably cost about 100 million quid these days, those unicorn strikers.
Well, that's what I mentioned in the other three I mentioned, because there aren't that many. You know, Darwin Nunez may be another one, but none of them are going to come cheap.
How many will want to transfer Minovic's World Cup year?
Well, I suppose it depends what their current circumstances are. I mean, the one advantage Arsenal have in terms of the market, which they may have lost some in terms of the Champions League, but one advantage they have is, you know, the World Cup's year's coming up, so players are going to be concerned. But any player that's in danger of playing for their country for the World Cup, if they're signing for Arsenal, they're signing to go into the team.
Yeah.
Particularly up front, or particularly in central midfield, because we know, you know.
Yeah, there's no competition for places there.
Well, not up front, certainly, yeah. can you walk? but it's also the fact that in recent years, the problems have been so interconnected and nebulous and kind of a mess, a melange of stuff. Whereas now, at least we're in a situation where we, like, the world and their wife knows where the holes are in the Arsenal squad. There's different approaches to filling those holes, but we all know what needs to happen. So any player that we're approaching is going to have a pretty fucking clear idea about where he sits in the pecking order, just depending on what position he plays. You know, if you're an eight who can also occasionally do roles and job in those two roles, you're going to be in the team. If you're a centre forward, you're going to be in the team. Or if you're a really established, maybe inside left / centre forward, even if you're not starting every game, you're going to get 40 games in the season, you know, done. You don't have to worry about it. And so that does give us an advantage where some other big teams who might be looking to supplement their squads, but not necessarily by a first choice player, you know, players don't want to miss the World Cups. They want to go where they're going to get played. And certainly Arsenal.
Maybe they don't this year. I don't know.
It's a tricky one, isn't it, though, as well?
Because it depends on their human rights stance. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also a tricky one because the very top level, you wouldn't expect players to be worrying about that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're signing a player who's worried about, are they going to get to go to the World Cup? They're probably not the kind of elite striker that we actually want / need. Like, for example, if United came in for Harry Kane, where United have Ronaldo, Harry Kane's not going to be sitting there going, am I going to get to play this season?
Yeah, but equally,
you know, are England not going to take me to the World Cup if I only play, you know, 2/3 of the games or something?
But equally, that level of striker is probably just above the level that we're realistically going to get. Ultimately, maybe that level of striker is going to, you know, Real Madrid didn't get Mbappe, so they're going to be sniffing around for that level of striker, you know. Admittedly, City have finally got their centre forward. United are going to spunk more stupid money and probably more ill-advised transfers this summer involving buying another striker. You know, Edison Cavani's left. We need to spend 60 million on his replacement. You know, that sort of nonsense. So I think the kind of players that are at that level where they don't have to worry are either playing for countries where there's not a lot of choice and therefore, you know, it's a different kettle of fish, or we're not going to be their first port of call, frankly. Because although we can offer very good wages compared to most of the European leagues, compared to the absolute elite clubs in those leagues or the rest of the top half, you know, top third of the Premier League, we can't significantly outspend those teams. So, but I'm not worried about it.
If we're sitting here talking about like the Calvert-Lewins of this world, for example, he doesn't even make the England squad.
Yeah, no, he'd come to a sort of shot because he's got nothing to lose and it'd be a great platform for him to.
And that's my point. That is not the profile of someone who should be our number one striker.
No, he's the person you buy if Eddie leaves as well. And you need two strikers.
Yeah.
And you're buying a different profile of other forward. You know, if say the Gabriel Jesus rumours are true, if you get him, then Calvert-Lewin as an alternative to him makes sense because you don't have to completely change your style, but because you've got mobility, but they offer very different things. Anyway, that sort of philosophical discussion about who should be doing what, brings this to a sort of natural close, or at least it does for me, because I have to leave, and I guess as I'm posting this, that means everyone else has to leave too, so one short. As I've said before, this is a more of a sort of just touching base and seeing where we are emotionally with things, rather than a full-on analytical where are we, state of the nation, where have we been, where are we going situation, which will be coming up in due course, because obviously there's the summer. And there's going to be podcasts every week, and we can't talk about everything all in one week. Otherwise, we're going to get very boring by mid-June.
Ellen can't. Can I just give a really quick shout-out to Bukayo Saka for being the first Arsenal player in 25 years to feature in every Premier League game for the Arsenal. The last person was Nigel Winterburn in 1996-1997.
Wow. Nigel Winterburn. There's no way you can look at the player other than that he's a star, and we're incredibly lucky to have him. And let's just
shouldn't be overplaying him.
Yeah, I mean, it is a thing of, you know, he shouldn't be playing that many games at his age.
Well, especially, you know, given that he came off the back of the Euros as well, and we weren't expecting to see him for a few weeks, were we?
No. I guess the form of Nicola Pepe made that Iron Man run slightly easier to cement.
He did produce an amazing bit of skill and shot on Sunday. I know it doesn't justify the 70 million quid, but it was a real whoa.
Yeah, the audible oohs were fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed one tweet I saw over the weekend saying one of those, you know, football news sites or something like that, football jokes or something, asked how if you could sell one player from your team for the price that you bought him for, who would it be? And I thought it's question ever for us.
Yeah, that's not a tricky one. Anyway, we'll have to wait and see how much of a loss that transaction ends up on. But I guess once you take accountancy into tricks and amortization, maybe it won't be that bad. Anyway, on that note, thank you very much again to Paul, Anita, and Helen, who's had to disappear out of the room and will be very confused when she comes back and we've all gone away, for talking to us all this week. Thank you, listeners, if you've got this far. And we'll speak to you again very soon. The podcast has been a bit irregular in terms of timing, but they're going to get much more regular again because I'm now in my new home and not having to spend every day of my life either packing up a house or opening up a new place or dealing with sisters or we're going to be much more regular with it, and I do have some plans afoot which we will keep you abreast of in due course. Until then, have a wonderful week, everyone. The football season is over from an Arsenal perspective, but that doesn't mean we can't still feel very happy.
A la Madrid.
And so say all of us. All right. Cheerio, everyone. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.